As has been our custom, we begin with a song. It's on the top of your page if you have an outline. And it is, the song's not technically, but the list is, so you can follow along. And it goes something like this. The fruit of the Spirit is a watermelon. The fruit of the Spirit is a watermelon. If you're a watermelon, you might as well hear it. You can't be a fruit of the Spirit, because the fruit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Very good. Self-control. Last week, I had it wrong on a number of the slides and on your outline. It's not Gentileness. It's gentleness. There's an extra I in there for some reason. I noticed it on some of them, and I forgot to remove it from all of them. I made that mistake too many times. So it's gentleness, but we are on self-control. What is self-control is how we begin each of these lessons. What is this attribute that the Bible tells us we should contain, we should possess, we should imbue into ourselves? And it made me think back to potlucks. Potlucks back when there were such a thing. Back in the bygone ages, feels like legend now, like we tell our kids about these days where we used to bring food together and have fun and sit together, of all things, but maybe one day we'll get back to it, but today is not that day, sadly. And I remember I was thinking about buying a cheesecake for my wife. That's the story that I was going to tell, and my wife said, no, and how I wasn't supposed to eat the cheesecake. I needed some self-control, and I need to make it holy, right? Make the cheesecake holy. And she goes, I got a better story. I said, okay. And she goes, you remember all the times I bought a cheesecake to take to potluck, and Saturday night you would beg me to eat a piece of that cheesecake? And I said, oh, yeah. Yeah, so we would regularly buy a dessert, right? We would have a main dish of some kind that we would take over to a potluck. And then we would also usually buy a dessert. And whenever my wife bought a cheesecake, I always wanted to eat one of the pieces on Saturday night. I would think about that cheesecake in there, and it would dwell in my mind. And I'm supposed to be, you know, putting the final touches on my sermon or getting the final touches on a Bible class. There's always something I'm supposed to be doing. And that cheesecake would really bother me. And I would always assume that if I could just have a piece of that cheesecake, it would really set my mind at ease. And then I'd be able to get whatever work needed to be done. It would get done, right? Because as the world tells us, indulging in those things obviously helps. It never does. That's a lie. And so my wife would be like, no, I'm not taking a cheesecake to potluck that's missing a piece. And I said, what's the big deal? And she said, no, I'm not taking a cheesecake that's missing a piece. So to me, that sounded more like a challenge. Like, how do I figure out how to get a piece out of this cheesecake without it seeming like there's a piece missing? And I came up with all kinds of different ways of solving this problem that I thought I was having. See, my wife and I disagreed on the problem we were having. I thought I just had to figure out how to get it done. She wanted me to stop thinking about it altogether. And I decided that maybe if I cut all the pieces and then I just separated them a little bit, no one would notice that there was, in fact, a whole piece missing. And there was all kinds of other ways. I considered dishing them all up ahead of time, even having to take a whole tray over of individually placed cheesecakes would keep people from noticing that there's one missing, because they don't know what the whole cheesecake looks like. That seemed like a good solution to me. In order for me to have a cheesecake, all it required was for me to carry upteen trays across the parking lot, make my life tomorrow that much more difficult so I could have a piece of cheesecake today. Isn't that the way we are with temptation? When we come to a situation where we need to express self-control, and we'll get to what it is in just a moment, rather than expressing that self-control and saying no, controlling ourselves, what we do is we find a way, or we seek to find a way around said problem. What we do is we try to find a way around the challenge that we're facing. And we do this with the Bible all the time. It's really frustrating. It frustrates me when folks do it, and it frustrates me when I find myself doing it. I don't find myself doing it as often as I probably do it. But when I come to a problem and I really want a solution, I try to find a way to that solution rather than finding out what the answer from the scriptures is. In 2 Peter chapter 3, And verse 10. 10 through 13. 10, 11, and 12. He's talking about the end of things. That all the stuff that we see around us will one day be dissolved. It will be destroyed. That all the elements will melt with fervent heat. And then he says there in verse 13, therefore, since all these things will be dissolved, what manner of persons ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness? Now, what I just realized now was that would have been a great argument for me trying to eat one of those pieces of cheesecake. It may be dissolved tomorrow, and this might not matter. I'm still stuck on that cheesecake. That's sad. The fact that nothing in this world is going to remain, nothing under the sun, as Solomon would say, nothing made of these elementary materials, none of them are going to remain, and that should change the way we look at things. If this is the case, what type of person should we be in holy conduct and godliness? You see the word holy there. We're talking about keep that cheesecake holy. The word holy, we assume, oftentimes means spiritual in nature. It doesn't. The word holy comes from the word hagios in the Greek, and it didn't mean spiritual in nature to them. It meant set apart. It meant set apart. My wife had set apart this cheesecake for the potluck, the whole cheesecake. I had set apart in my mind a piece of that cheesecake. That's not holiness to the whole of the cheesecake, and that was the problem. Keeping that cheesecake whole was the agenda, well, my wife's agenda, and me eating a piece did not keep it whole. It did not make it holy. And in that same way, in that same capacity, when we talk about self-control, it's about holiness. To whom do we belong? Who has final say in the things that we do in this life? Who has final control over the choices that we make? Well, we do, of course, but who should guide them? How should we make those choices? And because oftentimes, the things that we want to do in this world lead to physical manifestation. They lead to more money in our bank account or more time doing the things that we want. Or maybe it's we get to do something that we really want to do that God tells us not to. What type of person ought we to be in holy conduct and godliness? If this world is going to be destroyed, how should that change our perspective on the world around us? And how much simpler does it make when we keep this principle in mind to make the right choices? Now, we might have a number of years, even decades on the earth. Some of these young people may spend a century on the earth. Who knows? But that is nothing compared to the eternity that we look forward to. And that's Peter's argument here. You are selling your future eternity for some pleasure here on this earth, for something that you want now. And that is not a deal you should be making. But it is a deal that many people make. Self-control is about holiness. It's about being set apart for a purpose. And it's about respecting that set-apartedness and respecting what it calls us to do, that holy conduct and godliness. In 1 Peter chapter 1, if you go back just a few chapters, I guess 7 in particular, 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 13 through 16. I love the analogy that he gives here. It's not one that we would regularly use. He says, therefore, gird up the loins of your mind. I'm going to read that again. Gird up the loins of your mind. Be sober, which is a synonym for self-controlled, and rest your hope fully upon the grace that is to be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. He even gives you an analogy there. As obedient children, not conforming yourself to the former lusts, as in your ignorance, but as he who called you is holy, you also be holy in all your conduct. Gird up the loins of your mind. The concept of girding your loins was to wrap something around your waist to keep the shirt or the tunic that you were wearing from getting in the way. Right? I don't wear tunics nowadays, but I have an idea, right, of how this would work. We see this a lot through the Old Testament especially, but Jesus girded up his waist before in John chapter 13, before washing his disciples' feet. It's a wear a belt, basically, right? And you have probably seen people who were not wearing belts, and sometimes when they don't wear belts, yeah, I see a lot of people shaking their heads. They have it in their mind of these knuckleheads who wear their pants basically dragging the ground. And they think sometimes they think they're like thugs or something. And I'm like, if you did anything wrong, you'd immediately get caught because You ever tried to run when your pants were falling around your ankle? That's not easy. But that's kind of the way he's talking about. He's saying that's how you're handling your life. You're letting your mind drag around the gutter. And what we need to do with self-control, with holiness, respecting that relationship with God, we need to gird up the loins of our minds. We need to put a belt on. We need to tighten and restrict what our mind is allowed to roam to. Because when our mind's allowed to roam, it goes places it never was meant to go. It leads us into things that we should have never gotten into. And so restricting it accurately, restricting it well, that's what he means there when he says, gird up the loins of your mind. And then he says it again, basically, in a different way. He says, be sober, which I said before is a synonym for self-control. We think it only applies to alcohol, but sobriety from the Old Testament has nothing actually to do with alcohol itself. It has to do with controlling yourself in regard to anything. We have just taken it and applied it in particular to alcohol. And he says, and rest your hope fully upon the grace that is to be brought to you in the revelation of Jesus Christ. He says, as obedient children, not going back to those former lusts when you were ignorant, but being holy because the one who calls you is holy. In 1 Thessalonians 4 and verse 3. Look there in particular. 1 Thessalonians 4. In verse 3 he says, for this is the will of God, your sanctification, that you should abstain from sexual immorality, that each of you should know how to possess his own vessel in sanctification and honor. We just read that. Each of you should know how to possess his own vessel in sanctification and honor. That we're not controlled by any outside sources. And through this series, we've talked about many of the elements of how this plays out. And how self-control applies in gentleness when somebody makes us angry or is attempting to make us angry. And sometimes we would excuse that and we would say, oh, well, they made me angry, as if that excuses your bad behavior. No one can make you angry. No one can make you do anything. You allow yourself to be angry. You allow yourself to react out of that anger. And the Bible concludes here, not only in Galatians 5, that self-control is one of those important characteristics that we need to maintain and abound in, but that it keeps us from a lot of bad things. The expectation of anyone who would claim the name of Jesus, and you get into folks who think that certain activities are acceptable because, and they'll use this terminology, because I was born that way, because this is how I am. And it's not, honestly, it's not just homosexuality, it's any number of sinful activities. And they'll justify it by saying, well, this is how I was born. Well, this is how God made me. And we argue this to our detriment, because it has nothing to do with how they were born, how whether it's a natural occurrence or it's a product of their society, nature versus nurture, it has nothing to do with that. Because every human being has inclinations to do that which is wrong. If I have a propensity to murder, does that make it okay for me to murder? Is it now God's decision that I murder folks? I mean, there have been times where I was so angry that if something hadn't held me back, I may have hurt somebody. Did that make it okay because I had a propensity for that? No. And so we've argued the wrong point for a long time. We've argued the point whether or not they were born this way. That has nothing to do with it. What it has to do with is whether we decide and how we decide to move forward with our life. It's the choice that we make. And it has to do with self-control just as well in homosexuality as heterosexuality. God has ordained that through a marriage system and a godly marital system that we can indulge or embrace a sexual nature. But that also means that if we're married or if we're unmarried, we can't just have relations with whoever we want. Even if we have a propensity for it, it doesn't matter. God expects us to have self-control. And the same goes under any of the situations that we might find ourselves in, or any of the temptations we might find ourselves in, struggling with perhaps. Continue to struggle with it, because giving in is no answer. That is the opposite of self-control. And self-control is an expectation of God upon his people, regardless of how we feel or what we think. So how do we grow in self-control? Well, that's a really great question. That is not an easy thing to do. But one of the first inclinations is to understand that submitting to temptation does not help anything. That's what the devil tells us. That's what our heart tells us. That's what our desires tell us. Well, if you just give in this one time, whatever it is, everything, it'll be that much easier to handle next time. No. No, that's not the case at all. Unfortunately, I found that to be true from experience. I can tell you this from experience. Yielding to temptation does not help you with temptation. It makes it worse. Potentially, I don't know if I had to give it a number, a million times worse. A million. Don't ask for my grading scale. I'm just saying. 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 24. One of the ways that we grow in self-control is by determining the lines ahead of time. That is, draw lines. Draw lines. Now, we don't have the opportunity to draw lines for others. That's something that the Bible does talk about, and that's not acceptable. If we're drawing lines that aren't biblical for other people, we're doing it wrong. But you are absolutely allowed to draw lines for yourself. You want to put a stop on something ahead of time? Draw a line. All right? Decide ahead of time how far you're willing to go or where you need to stop. He says there in 1 Corinthians 9:24, he says, "Do you not know that those who run in a race all run, but one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may obtain it." That goes right back to 2 Peter 3. All right, since these things will be dissolved, what manner of persons ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness? Run in such a way that you want to attain the prize. He says, "And everyone who competes for the prize is temperate in all things. Now they do it to obtain a perishable crown, but we for an imperishable crown. Therefore, I run thus not with uncertainty, thus I fight not as one who beats the air." I don't do things just to do them. I make sure the things that I do matter. You don't go, if you're trying to compete in a sport, you don't just go to the gym and have no plan. That's not going to help you. That's not going to make you a better competitor in whatever sport it is. You need to, if you're going to do practice, it needs to be practice that is pointed towards your goal. And if you're going to work towards growing in a certain way, you need to practice growing in that way. He says, "But I discipline my body and bring it into subjection, lest when I have preached to others, I myself should be disqualified." The last thing that Paul wants is, while he is attempting to go to help other people find their path to heaven, that he himself gets disqualified from going. So what some people do is they try to figure it out as they go. Like, imagine somebody who's young who wants to be a boxer, right? They want to get into a Golden Gloves program. And they go into a gym, any old gym, and they just start punching a weight bag. They start punching it. They don't know how to punch. They don't know how to keep their hands up. They don't know any of the technique that's involved in becoming a boxer. But they think that this is going to solve all their problems. I just have to start punching a bag. They're not going to train well. And they're going to learn things that are going to have to be unlearned later. And they may very well hurt themselves. There are many athletes that end up hurting themselves because they don't know what they're doing. They just jump in and start doing things. But no athlete who is attempting to actually be successful does this. And neither do Christians. If we intend on being successful as Christians, at least I guess the word successful might feel weird at this point, but if we get to heaven, then we have succeeded, right? That's going to be my end goal, and that's going to be how I figure out whether I was successful or not. If I end up in hell, I must not have succeeded. But if I end up in heaven, cool, it worked. But I don't just beat the air. I discipline my body and I bring it into subjection. I have to set lines. I have to decide ahead of time. I have to make plans. You can't figure it out as you go, or your path is going to take you to failure. When I am teaching my daughter how to drive, your condolences are appreciated. One of the important rules concerning driving, and I don't know how many of you know this, it doesn't seem to be a very common thing in today's world, but one of the things I was taught was to always have an exit plan. In any situation, you're driving down the road, you maintain an exit plan. So if you're driving down the right side of the road and there's the brim on your right, that's your exit, right? If something bad happens in front of you, if the person in front of you stops abruptly, that might be your path to escape the damage that would take place. Always have an exit plan. But what happens when we're driving down the road, sometimes we don't maintain that self-control. Sometimes we can speed up a little bit and we can close the distance from the person in front of us because we lack control, or we lack self-control, self-discipline. And we remove that exit strategy. And then we get into a wreck because we did not have a plan to escape the issue. Jesus promises us, well, the Bible promises us that we don't deal with anything that's new. In fact, in what God does promise is that we'll not be challenged beyond what we are capable of dealing with, but we'll provide a way of escape. Now, that way of escape might not be what you want, but it sure beats whatever's in front of you. And we have to be ready, and we have to be disciplined to know how to get out of the trouble that we're in. Excuse me. We also need to be able to identify the situation or identify the issue. In James chapter 1 and verse 14, he says, "But each one is tempted when he is drawn away by his own desires and enticed. Then when his desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is full grown, brings forth death." Verse 16, "Do not be deceived, my beloved brethren." I don't want you to not understand this point, he says. Sin is a process. Temptation does not immediately cause sin. Temptation that is not handled correctly leads directly to sin. When we don't handle sin correctly, when we don't handle temptation well, when we don't take the exit strategies that are available, or we don't draw the lines ahead of time, imagine, one of the things I encourage young people to do is before they go to a place where there may be problems, like a party. You know, your friend invites you to a party. You think this friend is upright and everything should be fine. But then folks bring alcoholic beverages to their party. What are you going to do, right? If you just walk right into it and you don't have a plan ahead of time, have anticipated what might go wrong, you're going to be in a hard place saying no to things that you have not decided ahead of time. And your temptation is going to be to say yes because you want to get along with people, because you want folks to think you're cool, whatever the case might be. But to have those hard and fast rules ahead of time, to say even to yourself, and it sounds ridiculous sometimes. People look at me like I'm crazy. When I say this, literally say it out loud. Little things like that can help you in the long run to make the right choices, to demonstrate self-control. And it's not easy. I'm sure it wasn't easy for Jesus in Matthew 4 when he was hungry and the devil encouraged him to turn these rocks into bread, that he said no. And when the devil encouraged him to throw himself off the cliff, for him to say no. And for when the devil encouraged him to bow down to him and he would give him all that he sees before him at the pinnacle of the temple. And Jesus said no. But how did he say no? Like, imagine the way Jesus said no. He didn't say no, devil. He gave him scripture. Imagine answering people who are encouraging you to do something wrong. Imagine you answering it with scripture. How striking would that be? Imagine in your own life, if you came to a place because you were in God's word frequently enough, because you were committed to these things, and because you had thought ahead of time the struggles I might be. When I go to this friend's house, what kind of problems might I run into? And I think about it ahead of time, and I make decisions ahead of time. If this happens, this is what I'm going to do. If this happens, this is what I'm going to do. How much easier the choices in the moment are going to be. But we don't do that. In part because we really want to do those things sometimes. So we don't do the things in preparation. But you look at any athlete, and the athletes, what do? They have a tree that they've designed. If this happens, this is what I'm going to do. It's a quarterback in the NFL. He has a series of routes that he checks down each route. And if he gets to the end of that check down, or if he feels the pressure, his response needs to be throw the ball away, right? Don't take a sack. Now, that might be sports ball metaphor for some of you and might not work, but I'm working on better metaphors for everybody. I don't know. But it's this idea that we have to be ready. We have to be mindful. We have to know what we're getting ourselves into. And we have to be committed. And sometimes, as weird as it might be, you're walking into that party and you see things going on that shouldn't. You turn around and you walk right back out. And you don't care what people think of you. And you don't care how it looks. 1 Corinthians 6:18, 10:14, 1 Timothy 6:11, 2 Timothy 2:22. Flee sexual immorality, idolatry, flee youthful lusts, flee all these things, he says, but pursue righteousness. Sometimes it takes running away from things. Sometimes physically running away. Are we ready? Are we committed to our life in Christ to such a degree that when we come upon a situation that we are ill prepared for and we are likely to give into, that we run away from it? Literally, I mean literally, you turn around and you go the other direction. Now that might seem awkward to some of you, and that might seem ridiculous to many. That's exactly what Joseph did. He came to a situation, he didn't try to reason through it, he didn't try to talk Potiphar's well. At first he just said, this isn't going to happen. And Potiphar's wife pressed, he got to a point where he needed to leave. He needed to take the exit path, and it was a window. And he took the window, because taking the window is better than staying in the situation. That's self-control. As ridiculous as it looks to the people around you, that is an aspect of self-control. That I am more committed to this thing that I am committed to, in this case God, than I am to looking appropriate to people around me, to not being prosecuted by Potiphar's husband or by Potiphar over this situation, by not getting into trouble or whatever the case might be. My relationship with God is more important. 2 Peter 3:13, therefore, since all these things will be dissolved, what manner of persons ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness? What kind of person should we be? If we believe that the end of the world will come inevitably, and in that end, not only will everything here be destroyed, but eternity will begin, how committed are we? What will that commitment cause us to do? What lines will we draw? And we will tell ourselves, I'm not going to cross this line. And if we get into a situation where I might, I'm going to jump out the window. How do we grow in self-control? Sometimes simply by removing ourselves from situations. I had convinced myself for a time that it was a good thing to be tempted, because I would grow in self-control as I was tempted. But it was a thing that I was not ready to handle. So I didn't handle it, and I didn't grow in self-control. I actually waned in self-control, thinking that I was going to grow in it. That didn't help at all. And that was my interest in sin getting the better of me. That was the devil, or it was my nature. It was that part of me that isn't helpful to my spirituality that told me that staying in the temptation is a good thing. It helps me grow. No, it doesn't. Avoiding temptation. That's self-control. And how does self-control sweeten the Christian's life? It's a fruit of the Spirit. And as I've said before, fruit are supposed to be sweet. In Proverbs 25, 28, whoever has no rule over his spirit is like a city broken down without walls. That doesn't mean as much to us today. I don't know how many cities in America actually have walls. But it was a very important thing in the time, because it kept marauders from just entering the city on a whim. It kept armies at bay to a large degree. It gave you an opportunity to repel the invading army if that happened. But cities without walls were inviting prey for their enemies, and they would be ransacked regularly. That was the problem when the Israelites came back. When Babylon had come and had conquered, they didn't leave the wall standing. In fact, even after they had broken the wall initially and conquered the city ultimately, they went ahead and continued to break the wall down, because they wanted access to the city whenever they wanted access to the city. And if you refuse to develop self-control, you, like that city, will just be ransacked regularly. Because 1 Peter 5:8, be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, walks around like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. In verse 9, he gives you the answer, but resist him steadfast in the faith. Resist him and he will flee from you. Draw near to God and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, ye sinners, and purify your hearts, ye double-minded, James says. In Proverbs 16 and verse 32, there is exceedingly great profit in self-control. What we see in this world today, people lack self-control. We talked about athletes and how much emphasis they put on controlling their bodies. I mean, the thing some of these athletes can do is remarkable. It's impressive. Think about, there's no way you're going to win Wimbledon or NFL championships or NBA championships or Olympic gold medals without putting the time and effort into self-control, your physical body. But then some of these people, they get to the net and something doesn't go their way and they're screaming or throwing their racket into the stands or yelling at referees or doing all kinds of drugs. They might show a physical restraint for various things. They won't eat certain things, but they'll smoke anything that comes their way. That's not self-control. And that's not especially emotional stability. Self-control is not just the person, it is also the mind. And there is exceedingly great profit. He says, "He who is slow to anger is better than the mighty. And he who rules his spirit than he who takes a city." Now, cities in the world today, or in our world anyway, in America, aren't taken, right? We're not going to go conquer St. Louis. That's not how this works. Elkhart takes over Mishawaka. That's not how this works. But in the day, it definitely did. Imagine being one of those individuals who helped David conquer Jerusalem. Or when Caleb was offering his daughter for help clearing the land of the Gentiles that were there. He offered his daughter. There is great profit. But if you rule your spirit, there is even greater profit. Romans chapter 12 and verse 1, he says, "I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, wholly acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service." The expectation is that we be under control. We can't give our lives to Christ, and he will not take them if we are not under control, if we do not deal with ourselves and our issues first. It's easy for us to look across the pew and to see the difficulties that other people are sustaining. It's easy to give advice. It's hard to take it. It's easy to see where other people need to make corrections. It's hard sometimes to see in ourselves, but that's what self-control is. It is a willingness and a commitment to do the right thing beyond the easy thing, beyond the fun thing even sometimes, but the thing that is best for our eternal soul. And it is necessary for your future and eternity. If you need to put your life right with God, if you are ready to control yourself, not perfectly, that's never going to happen, but work towards developing self-control, coming to a point where you have an exit strategy for the things that may go on in your life, where you can put your soul wholly in God's hands and know that he is certain and is steadfast, that you want to commit your life to him, and we can help you to do that today. And if we can help you to come back to him because you've been wayward in your course, or you need to come and ask for help through the difficulties of this life, you have but to ask, and you have a family here that cares, that wants to help you through all these things. If we can help you, I pray that you would let us know as together we stand and sing.